Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Hello and welcome back to Black's History Week. In this episode, Professor Jeremy Black talks to Graham Stewart about how Nazi foreign policy differed from the traditional objectives of German nationalism.
Following on from our earlier discussions about Hitler and the Third Reich, we come to foreign policy. Now, foreign policy may be a misnomer in a sense because we understandably think of it primarily in terms of preparing for war. And I think that that is a correct assessment. From the outset, Hitler, who had always had more than a bellicose rhetoric, he'd had a warlike worldview and a notion of millenarianism in which races were in conflict and peoples in acute rivalry. It's not surprising in light of all that, that war was to the utmost in his thoughts from the word go. But of course, that did not mean that he necessarily assumed that that war would break out at once, or that he wanted it to break out at once, or that he didn't want through diplomacy to provide himself with the opportunity to strengthen Germany in preparation for such a conflict. And also, crucially, he wanted, in a sense, sequential war making, rather like the wars of German unification between 1864 and 1871, when Prussia, subsequently Germany, had engaged its major opponents separately. This also was Hitler's intention. Now, one of the difficulties in judging Nazi Hitler's foreign policy is, of course, that we know that war is going to come. We know that it's going to come in 1939. And understandably, in light of the importance of World War II, there is a tendency to discuss foreign policy in terms of the response to Germany, not least the debate over appeasement. All of these are understandable. I think it's fair to say they're not the complete picture. After all, one needs to be aware, and this affected not just the response to Germany, which we've already discussed in earlier programmes under different heads. There is one on appeasement on this, this series. But also, as far as Hitler was concerned, there were other conflicts, and how he interacted with them was significant. In particular, while Germany was economically stronger than both Japan and Italy when he came to power in 1933, this was not the case militarily. And both of those were expansionist powers, revisionist powers, in the sense that they wanted to revise international agreements to their advantage. And the extent to which Germany could benefit from those was unclear. Initially, the theme was a rather quiet rearmament, in the sense, as far as outside observation was concerned, Hitler was not, for outside audiences, pushing his bellicosity at the outset. But this changed in 1936 when he unilaterally remilitarized the Rhineland. The Rhineland had been demilitarized as part of the post-World War I settlement. And that, of course, gave France a, as it were, buffer zone in front of it. And Hitler unilaterally remilitarized it. It might have been the case, had he set out to alter its status through diplomatic means, that he might have succeeded in that. But that was clearly not his intention by 1936. He unilaterally militarized it and also initiated a four-year plan designed to ensure both self-sufficiency economically, but also readiness for war. And the two were closely linked. For Hitler, economics was an aspect of war. You might argue this goes right back to mercantilist thought, in the 17th century. It certainly cut across any idea of liberal economics, because there was to be no reliance on trade. Instead, there was to be a theme of autarky, of national self-sufficiency. This remilitarization, like rearmament, was an attempt, and it was cast as an attempt, to regain Germany's former position. In other words, the rhetoric about the pernicious nature of the Versailles peace settlement, which had always been a characteristic of Hitlerian discourse, became much more overt and much more pushed to the fore in diplomacy. But when Hitler occupied Austria on the 12th of March 1938, uniting it with Germany in the so-called Anschluss, which means union, the following day, this was more than a revision of the Versailles settlement. Up to then, it had been possible, misleading in many respects, but possible, to argue that Germany was just seeking to revise Versailles. Now it was clear that there was a fundamental redrawing of the map of Europe. And this Anschluss was publicly labelled in 1938 as a reunification, as a sort of re-knitting of the German people, which of course had not been the logic of pre-World War I international thought. There had been no intention there. There'd been one or two, obviously, commentators had suggested it, but there'd been no intention there to look at a, as it were, a German people's state. Later in 1938, Hitler turned on Czechoslovakia, where there was an ethnic majority of Germans in the area of the Sudetenland. That's the area that abuts onto Germany. In practice, his bullying, and it was bullying, and it was accompanied by political activism in among Sudeten Germans, not all Sudeten Germans, of course, but among Sudeten Germans. In practice, his bullying relied in part on bluster. At the time, he lacked enough trained troops, while shortages in raw materials hit German armaments production. Indeed, I think it's fair to say that German rearmament throughout had a kind of shop window character and was a failure in many ways. There was little appropriate long-term planning, and aside from the serious shortage of iron and steel that hit production, there was a lack of skilled workers. Moreover, Germany's dire fiscal situation greatly exacerbated the problems created by its shift to all oil-based weapon systems. I mean, in essence, Germany is trying to arm rapidly, so, for example, is the Soviet Union, but Germany is seeking to do so not only when it's not got the oil production that the Soviet Union has in Azerbaijan, around Baku and other areas as well, but also when it's trying to give its citizens a, by the standards of the age, reasonable standard of living. Whereas, of course, in the Soviet Union, there is absolute brutality and harshness and, in effect, a slave labor society. And therefore, rearmament is, in a way, easier to impose. Fortunately for Hitler, in 1938, Czechoslovakia was isolated. You know, there had been in the 1920s a French attempt to develop a international system in Eastern Europe, particularly resting on Czechoslovakia, Poland, and Yugoslavia, and also to a degree Romania, and directed against a sort of revisionist Hungary. This didn't work in 1938. Hungary was obviously on the side of the Axis, but so in terms of failing to provide any support for Czechoslovakia, and indeed eventually gaining a section of Czechoslovakia, was Poland. Anyway, an isolated Czechoslovakia was under pressure from the other powers and was driven to accept the German occupation of the Sudetenland, with at the time, of course, in the so-called Munich Agreement, a, as it were, undertaking by Hitler that he would not seek to revise subsequently the status of Czechoslovakia, which of course was something he was to breach completely the following March. The Munich Agreement helped thwart both the short war that Hitler had hoped for. He wanted a short war against Czechoslovakia in order to demonstrate his military prowess, in order to intimidate others, but also a plot for a coup organized by Ludwig Beck, the chief of the Army General Staff. It's worth pointing out that Beck, a serious figure, was not supported by more than a portion of the military. So I think it would be wrong to say that this was a would-be military coup in the sense of a coup by all of the military. This was a would-be coup by some of the military. That might have been successful, and of course, that's a theme that's discussed, was discussed for the wider public in Robert Harris's recent novel and then film Munich. But on the other hand, it might also have very much failed. In March 1939, Hitler renounced the guarantees he'd made at Munich and destroyed Czechoslovakia. It's clear that that was his intention throughout. The following month, he renounced the 1935 Anglo-German naval agreement through which the British government had sought to anchor Germany, possibly foolishly, possibly not foolishly. My own view is foolishly, in the kind of system that had been created with the Washington naval treaties of limitations on naval strength. However, Hitler, although he renounced that agreement, didn't wish to go to war with Britain and did not expect that country to begin hostilities in the summer of 1939. Indeed, he was himself undecided about whether or not to go to war with Poland. This was a much more formidable military challenge, a far larger military than Czechoslovakia, let alone than Austria. And also, I think it's fair to say that whereas in Austria there had been a considerable amount of sympathy with Hitler, as well as only a so much willingness to fight against Germany. And whereas in the case of Czechoslovakia, there had obviously been support for Hitler in the Sudetenland, though not more widely, other than to a degree in Slovakia. In Poland, there was very little indeed support for the Germans. Invading Poland was a very different prospect. It was larger militarily. It indeed had succeeded when the Soviet Union had invaded, attacked it in the last stages of the Russian Civil War. And although there was subsequently to be arguments about the anachronism of Polish military and images of Polish cavalrymen attacking German tanks, and although there were definitely weaknesses in some aspects of the Polish army, as has recently been argued by Roger Moorhouse in his excellent book on 1939, the conflict between Germany and Poland, the Poles were actually militarily more potent than that image suggests, and that in many senses we bought into the German propaganda that was publicized for its public. Anyway, so Hitler was undecided. A key element in his decision was his assurance by his foreign minister, Joachim von Ribbentrop, who had been ambassador to London, and whilst ambassador had very much hung around with sort of far right-wing aristocratic circles, and also on top of that believed like so many Nazis did in telling Hitler what he wanted to hear, and on top of that had a view of the British as decadent. He assured Hitler that Britain would never declare war to protect Poland, so which of course was totally wrong. On the 5th of April 1939, Wilhelm Keitel, the head of the Wehrmacht High Command, told the Italian Chief of Staff that no war was to be expected for, quote, 3 or 4 years, which accorded with Ribbentrop's approach to Mussolini in late 38, when he offered an alliance and promised no war for 2 or 3 years. So in other words, the Germans were sending mixed messages around, not least to themselves at that point. And while I think it's fair to say that the logic of the German system was towards war, that doesn't mean that specifically there was the intention to fight the lineup that was to emerge in the summer of 1939. Crucially, in order to facilitate action against Poland and to offset whatever Britain might do, Hitler concluded a 10-year non-aggression pact with Stalin, which was negotiated and signed on the 23rd to 24th of August 1939. This agreement is often named after the two foreign ministers, Ribbentrop and Molotov, and was celebrated at its signing in Moscow by Stalin with a toast to, quote, the health of this great man, which was Hitler, who was not present at that occasion. It's worth bearing in mind whenever you are inclined to feel, as some people obviously, some commentators are, sympathetic to Stalin. It's worth thinking about that occasion. The pact had secret clauses that determined spheres of influence in Eastern Europe, leaving no effective independence for local states and no role for other European powers, nor for international organizations. It was very different to the nature of the negotiations, the guarantees that the British and the French had offered both Poland and Romania. And this whole notion of spheres of influence between Germany and the Soviet Union was very different indeed to the character of what has been referred to as appeasement. I mean, insofar as there was appeasement, the leading appeasement power, well, indeed ally of Nazi Germany was, of course, the Communist Soviet Union. To his delight, Hitler was therefore freed from the prospect of a two-front war against major powers, and therefore apparently from risking a repetition of the stalemate of the First World War. The First World War, you will remember, Germany had simultaneously gone to war on the Western Front, France and Britain, and on the Eastern Front with Russia. Now, it appeared to be the case that on the Eastern Front, there would only be a weak Poland, which would be very vulnerable because of the Soviet Union was now its enemy. There would not be the need to fight the Soviets, and therefore that Germany would be in a stronger position. The pact also had great strategic importance as Hitler was seeking to counter the effects of a possible British blockade, which he viewed as being partly responsible for domestic disaffection within Germany in World War I, and he was therefore hoping to get imports of grain, of oil, and of other resources from the Soviet Union, as indeed he was to do. That the home front could suffer as it did in the First World War was therefore of concern to him and therefore to German strategic planning. And I think that's a point that's always worth bearing in mind. Hitler had a rather odd, in many respects, attitude towards the German people. He saw him as their leader. He saw them as his obvious followers and his keen followers, but he was also concerned that they could be weakened by other factors. So he would argue that they had been weakened by communism, socialism, consumerism, and the presence of Jews. And he was to be worried in wartime that they might be affected by the constraints of war. Stalin had far less concerns about the situation in the Soviet Union. In combination with the fact that he didn't have now to face opponents who were so formidable as Germany had done in 1914, the pact made the war possible in the form it was to take. And thus the Soviet Union carries part of the responsibility for what happened, although this was something that it was subsequently largely able to evade. Such an agreement was not necessary to overcome Poland, but certainly weakened it. I mean, in 1939, Poland suffered from the fact that it was exposed to attack, but even before the Soviets came in, exposed to attack from the north, where East Prussia was part of Germany, from the west, where main Germany was, and from the south, as there were German troops in Czechoslovakia, including in what was now the client Republic of Slovakia, which was a German ally and which took part in the war. So Poland now, vulnerable in a number of directions, it lacked the necessary strategic defence, irrespective of Russia's deep enmity. However, the 1939 pact both helped to speed up Poland's defeat and was the key strategic element in the fall of France in 1940. So I think what we'll do is stop there for a second to review the peacetime years, so-called. But the key point I want to make was that redressing the 1919 Versailles peace settlement was at best a tactic for Hitler, as indeed was cooperation with the Soviet Union to be in 1939 to 1941.
Well, that's a very good point, Professor Black, on which to pause and to for me just to ask some questions about what you've been discussing. I'd like to start, if I may, by getting your sense of where the foreign policy objectives of traditional German nationalism end and where Nazism starts. To what extent is Nazism a supercharged form of German nationalism, or to what extent is it an entirely different animal?
Well, I mean, I think that's a very interesting question. I mean, nationalism takes very many different forms, as you'll know in the discussion about 19th century Germany, the established discussion in the literature. There is the theme of a liberal nationalism, which is seen as playing particularly a role, as we mentioned in an earlier programme, with the Frankfurt Parliament, with 1848. And there's the theme of a conservative nationalism, a sort of blood and soil nationalism, which is seen as playing a role later in that century. And I think possibly there is a degree to which people over-rationalize contrasting strands. What I would say is that nationalism is a political and philosophy and cultural practice and rhetorical structure which is linked to the primacy of the nation in political debate. And as such, you might argue, is true of many societies, both democratic and authoritarian. It contrasts, I think one could fairly say, with internationalism, which is one that puts, at least in theory, international issues, alignments foremost. And as instances of that, you can see, although no way suggesting an equivalence, Catholicism or communism. And it also contrasts with the idea that within whatever you mean by the people or the country or the state or indeed the nation, that the prime focus should be on social, ethnic, religious, regional, cultural differences and commitments. Now, if you're to take that broad approach, then I think it's fair to say that, yes, the Third Reich is a form of nationalism, extreme nationalism, if you wish to use that term. I mean, it's certainly extremist, but whether you want to use the term extreme nationalism, I'm not quite sure how helpful that is. But obviously, that does not simply explain the nature of the Third Reich, not least because the idea of the people, the Volk, the nation, if you like, is highly racialized, so that those people who might be citizens, members of the German nation, who the Nazis don't want, of which the obvious example are Jews, but Jews are not the only example, are not part of this nationalism. So you might say it's a acute idea of a sort of racial identity, and indeed a form of identity politics, very somewhat different, you might say, to where we are at the present moment, but possibly that is something that has echoes, a kind of, you know, that there is a ethnic essentialism. So I'm not sure I would be happy to think just simply of the Third Reich as nationalism, because inherently so were many other states of that period, so were the Poles who fought the Germans. And it's rather difficult to say one is a more, in your terms, extreme nationalist than the other.
Mm. So if we were to draw a comparison with a 1920s German liberal nationalist like Gustav Stresemann, he would have shared what you call the Hitler's tactic of redressing what such Germans saw as the iniquities of Versailles, but would have probably stopped there. So in essence, rearming in the same way that other European nations could rearm, reoccupying the Rhineland militarily. But when we talk about the Anschluss and beyond, that is where Stresemann would not have gone.
Well, we can't, I mean, Stresemann was dead, obviously, by the time of the Anschluss, so we can't say what he would have done. But I think it's fair to argue that he was more committed to multilateral diplomacy. He wanted a stabilization of international relations, and within that context wanted Germany as far as possible to be reintegrated into the family of nations. There were aspects in the 1920s of a, I suppose one could say, more troubling German politics, not least the alignment with the Soviet Union in terms of military preparedness and military training and experimentation, as you may know, with tank warfare. But I think it's fair to say that there was a marked difference for the implementation and practice and rhetoric of politics, international politics, between Weimar centrists and Nazis.
Mm. Should we distinguish between Hitler's goal, which is to say the unity of ethnic German peoples and indeed their overlordship over Slavic nations and nations that Hitler wanted to have Lebensraum over, and the plan. So there's an objective, but the route to achieving it. Talking about the plan, was there a plan, or was Hitler an opportunist just constantly reacting to contingencies and the misreading of the situation by other European leaders?
Well, I think there's both. I mean, you know, there are occasions when he outlines to people his long-term aspirations, and you can, if you like, call those a plan. But in terms of the implementation, he necessarily necessarily is responding to circumstances, because Germany is only one of the powers in Europe. So I think it's a mixture of both. I think the opportunities for him increase from 38. And I think the that means, in a way, paradoxically, a crisis would be the wrong word, but a need for him to, which he's not good at, to focus on what he actually wants in practice as opposed to in rhetoric. And I think you see some of the hesitations in German policy in 39 as reflecting the fact that the key movement, which is the possibility of an alignment with the Soviet Union, throws up issues of what should be done now, as opposed to the easy thing of saying what we'd like to have done in a year's time.
Do you see Hitler as, in essence, his own foreign minister? I mean, you've mentioned the advice, bad advice, mostly from the likes of Ribbentrop. But did Hitler actually take an act on such advice, or was he always just minded to do whatever his own instincts told him were right?
Well, I think that Ribbentrop, in a way, is like Goebbels, somebody that or Rosenberg, for example. These are people that exaggerate their own significance. I think Hitler himself, yes, I would say that I wouldn't call him his own foreign minister in the sense that he is not providing a detailed instructions to diplomats, but in terms of directing attitudes and implementing them through the mechanisms of the state, I think Hitler benefits from the fact that he is militarizing foreign policy, which therefore means that the foreign ministry is of less consequence, and also that he is using the mechanisms of the intelligence services, of which Germany has more than one, in order to get his own understanding of what is happening, though that implies a degree of reason on his part. I mean, to a great extent, as I've already mentioned in another program, he's a lazy man, and to a great extent, he is allowing his assumptions to help guide him in his understanding of the situation. But he's not dependent on diplomats, and he is, there is a degree of militarization of German policy in which he is the directing force, and in which the diplomats only have so much to offer. And I think it's fair to say that Hitler never liked the Wilhelmstrasse, you know, where the foreign ministry was. And I think it's fair to say there was a cultural difference there that was quite significant.
One thing I've never really understood, and it's really the key to the Second World War as it plays out, is why he invaded Poland. If we look at him in terms of someone wanting to unify Germans, then you know, beyond Danzig, there isn't really a case for invading Western Poland. Why bring all these Poles into the Reich? It doesn't seem to make sense.
Well, that's a very interesting question. And there is a rather good book that looks at, by a German scholar, that looks at German military planning in the 30s, including military planning for cooperation with Poland against the Soviet Union. And you could argue, and I mean, hypotheticals and contingencies play a role always in discussing the Third Reich, and possibly an excessive role. But you could argue that this is one of many failures of judgment on the part of Hitler, that that had he wanted or to have a kind of anti-Soviet crusade, that his brutalization of Poland, not just his attacking it. But after that, the extraordinarily violent way in which the Germans occupied it represented the failure to think this way through. In other words, you could argue that Hitler, and I have argued this in my book on strategy in the military history of strategy, Hitler was a classic operationalist as opposed to a strategic thinker. And I think there's a lot to be said for that. On the other hand, there was a kind of lazy incrementalism there, a preference for thinking of what could be regarded as short-term fixes. Here was an opportunity he didn't like. He despised Slavs. He wanted to sort out what he regarded as the Polish corridor problem. Here was an opportunity to do this in cooperation with the Soviets, and whilst isolating, you know, or ensuring that the Western Europeans didn't do anything, let's grab at that without thinking about the long-term consequences, which incidentally included moving the Soviet border and therefore the area that in the event of war Germany would have to conquer considerably further west, as indeed was the case. But you're absolutely right if you're thinking in what we might regard as rational terms. But there are several things to bear in mind here. First, there is a problem in, I would argue, it's a systemic problem in writing about not just history, but also about politics today or considering the future, which is this problem of what I call optimalization, the assumption that in any one situation, there is a optimal outcome and that there is a best, clear best practice for the various players in the system, whether they're state, social groupings, whatever, economic interests, and that the nature of politics is therefore to bring these together. That's a very benign view. I wish it was true. It doesn't give me any pleasure to say this, but it's a fundamentally flawed viewpoint because it ignores the extent to which notions of value and interest are culturally and ideologically defined and constrained. And I think that's a very important way to understand not just pathologies. You know, Hitler was a sociopath. He was, by any and every standard, what we mean by evil. But not just pathologies, but also governance and government and people's interests as a whole. So if one's looking at what might rationally be of interest to Hitler, one might in a way be looking at a question that's mal posé, falsely posed. I mean, you could argue from the point of view of his assumptions, should he have done A rather than B? But that depends upon the view that you assume that he has fixed assumptions that were capable of a implementation and an implementation that would have made sense in terms of his assumptions. And I think that's a very difficult standpoint to get into.
Yes, very difficult to get inside the mind of Hitler. No shortage of historians have tried. Professor Black, we must leave it there, but Jeremy Black, who's A Brief History of Germany, is available in paperback for taking us through the German foreign policy of Adolf Hitler in the 1930s. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk.